Why should it matter to people on the outside, people in the community, that this is happening to people within prisons?
Because we're coming back. Okay. That's the short answer. I mean, you know, it's kind of like if you lock a dog in a cage and you poke it for a long time, do you want to be there when that cage door is opened? Of course not. If that dog gets off that leash that's been chained up, you know, out there in the backyard for a year or 2 years, and it's, you know, every time somebody walks by, it just barks and growls and goes crazy. Do you want to be the person there when it gets off that leash?
This podcast is being recorded on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee people. As students at Queen's University, we recognize the traumatic role that Kingston has played as a colonial city and that the ongoing harm enacted in its federal prisons disproportionately affects Indigenous people. We strongly believe that decolonization is fundamental in dismantling oppressive and carceral systems and acknowledge our roles in contributing to it.
Rehabilitation must be improved in Canadian prison systems, but what is it and why is it needed?
This podcast seeks to answer these questions by amplifying ex-offenders' voices and shedding light on their experiences in the criminal justice system. Bolstered by stories from restorative justice advocates, academics, and grassroots community organizers, we will explore why people commit crimes, how they serve their time, and why it matters. This episode contains discussions of substance abuse, addiction, trauma, self-harm, depression, and suicide, so please take care of yourselves as you listen.
Pete is the National Program Manager at Seventh Step Society Canada, a program designed to help offenders and ex-offenders change their behavior and attitudes using a basic self-help philosophy. Its fundamental principles are realistic thinking and positive peer pressure. Pete himself was sentenced to a total of 16 years in prison, and he dedicates his time to helping other ex-offenders. Today, he's joining us from Halifax, Nova Scotia, the traditional territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
I've been involved with corrections since before I was born. And so by that, I mean that my father was actually incarcerated when my mother was pregnant. And my grandfather, who was a part-time preacher at the time, my mother's father, he had actually wrote a letter to the parole board to get him released prior to me being born so my parents could be getting married so I wouldn't be born out of wedlock. So that's where my story starts. So.
Pete grew up on a military base in Halifax. When he would get into trouble as a teenager, the military let his father handle things at home.
Luckily, I didn't end up incarcerated as a juvenile because my mother and father were divorced when I was five, and my mother remarried a guy that was in the military in the Navy here in Halifax. As soon as I stepped off the base at 18, I ended up in prison. My addictions was pretty rampant at that time with alcohol and, THC, I guess. I was drinking and smoking dope every day, and I started doing crime to supply the habits and hang around with the crew, you know, that was doing break and enters and stuff like that. And it just took off from there.
Though sentenced to a total of 16 years, Pete spent 12 and a half years in prison in both federal and provincial institutions.
A few months later, I relapsed and things were getting really bad. I couldn't keep a job again. And, everything was on the cusp of turning really nasty, we'll say. And my brother overdosed and died. And I was standing in his funeral, and it was all my family friends. It was my brother's funeral, so it was all our same people. And I remember standing there and looking around, and I was devastated. He was 10 years younger than me. So I remember standing there in the funeral home and looking around. I'm thinking, you know, if I don't stop, this is what I'm going to do to them. I've been at a prison. It'll be 15 years this year.
During his time in the federal system, Pete spent a total of 4 years in a maximum security institution called Renus.
I don't know how or why I managed to make it out. I'd say half sane anyway, but I don't know how I made it out with, you know, the capacity that I had, because I've watched over and over and over again so many people especially maximum security prisons, the tension is so thick all the time that you're, you know, your back is against the wall. You just, those neural pathways in your brain become so strong that, you know, to walk out of there and to be able to change those and change the direction of your life and your way of thinking becomes harder, right? But prison in general will do that. I've been in segregation units that, you know, covered with feces, blood. You know, they give you a mattress about, you know, 3 inches thick, and then you throw it on a steel bunk or concrete slab, and that's your, give you a couple of hospital blankets, and that's what you get. You know, they put you in a jumpsuit of some kind, and you're in there, like I said, 23 hours a day. They let you for your hour to walk around in circles in a bigger room, and that's about it, right? And a lot of the time, if they don't have enough staff, if somebody calls in sick or whatever, then you may not even get it for that hour, right? So there's, it's, and then the mental health, like I said, I've seen some, I mean, not including myself, like I've already mentioned that, you know, I've come close to cracking a couple of times where my mind would be racing. I wouldn't be able to stop it. I would be going down to, my anxiety would go through the roof, depression, you know, like I would think about committing suicide over and over again. You know, I've seen horrendous things happen in those segregation units, you know, people hanging themselves or cutting themselves or, you know, creating body harm, you know, like just, they just can't deal with it any longer, right? You know, and it's, they think that they're trying to break you, right, is what it is. And I always refer back to, can you imagine doing that to an animal? The SPCA would be called on you in a heartbeat. You'd be up on charges and everything. Imagine if you locked an animal in a cage 24 hours a day and then give it the bare minimum to live off of, and the dog was chewing at itself and everything else, and you didn't do anything to help it. You'd be charged and put in prison. But yeah, we do it every day.
Pete remembers his first day in prison vividly.
Very, very humiliating experience. You know, like they bring you in, and the staff out there, there was nothing soft about them. You know, they're just like very demanding on what they want to expect from you, what you're doing. You know, get in there, you know, slamming the big doors behind you. Very degrading. You know, you're stripped down, you know, spread your butt cheeks apart in front of people you don't know. You get to lift, you know, body parts up in front of them, and you know they're up like looking at you from top to bottom, every part, crevice of your body. Like it's very, very dehuman. I mean, again, I'll go back to, can you imagine if we did that in the community? If somebody did that to anybody in the community, you'd be charged, man. You'd have serious charges. But it's okay to do it with this person because, well, you know, they did a break and enter. So you can, you know, dehumanize them over and over and over again. So every time that you move from one prison to another, they do that again. So anytime that you walk out the door and come back in, they do that again. Like everything is always, you're stripped down, right? You know, and if they suspect something, they'll put you in a segregation. They call it the dry cell. For 72 hours and make you go to the bathroom and everything prior to letting you out. You're on a camera and light 24 hours a day. So there's like, you know, but when you first, like I said, when I first went in, it was just like, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know, you know, anything about it. I was pretty scared. I was a kid. I mean, I had to put a good face on. You're kind of stuck between being scared, but you can't show it. Right? You can't show any fear because you're going into predatory based environments, right? So like I said, everybody in there has all the bad habits of dealing with life. And so when you walk in there, it's very predatory. Everybody's looking at you. What can I get from you? You know, are they a rat? Are they, you know, are they this? Are they that? You know, it's. So I remember I took the steel locker after I went through all the initial getting to the institution, pick up the steel locker, and I get to the range and you know, very intimidating in there, you know, big barriers and bubbled glass with the, you know, the guards behind it with assault rifles and everything else. And you're like, oh yeah, I'm in the big boys yard now, right? There's no more games up here. And anyway, I walked in the range. And when I walked on the range, I look around and everything stopped. Guys were playing cards. Other guys were chatting over here, like, you know, on the short range or, you know, over congregation part of the range. Everything stopped, right? Barrier opens up and this new guy comes on the range and everybody just stands there and looks. And I mean, like, I'm 19. So the average age was probably 40. The average sentence is probably 15 years. And I'm 19 doing 3.5 years.
For Pete, the most difficult part of incarceration occurred in segregation.
You know, I think the longest that I did was probably about 30, 40 days straight. But you really don't know how much that could affect you until you're in that position. If you're completely segregated from all human contact, 24 hours a day. So yeah, there were definitely times, but the problem is that what happens is when a person reaches that point, and it happens all the time inside prisons, where a person reaches that point where they're like, I don't want to do this anymore. But then there's no support. It's not like, oh, I can go to a meeting right now. Do you know what I mean? Or I can pick the phone up and call somebody to support me. Or I can talk to a counselor. Or I can reach out to addictions counseling. Or I can, do you know what I mean? You can't do any of that. So you're, even though people hit those points, and I hit it multiple times. I remember the first time that I went on the parole board, I was sitting in the hole in Spring Hill, and I was waiting to go to Renews when I was 19. And my parole board hearing was up. So I went on the board and I'm like, I'm sitting in segregation at this point, I don't know, probably for a couple of weeks at least. And I looked at the board and I went, they were like, how do we know that you're not going to do anything if we let you up? I said, well, I'm going to tell you something. I looked right at the board and I kept saying it over and over and over again to them. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. But I was already in a position where, you know, they didn't have anything to work with. Like, you know, I'd already been, you know, involved with a couple assaults, you know, they thought on paper. So I was being shipped to Renews. They knew that. But yet here I am going on the board. Like, and that's all I kept saying. I'm like, you know, I'm scared. I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be here. I'm done. I'm, you know, if you let me out now, I would not come back here. But there was nothing. My support was getting shipped to a maximum security, right? Too bad about you. This is what you did. Now you got to deal with it. I think I recognized probably that there was a serious chance that I could never get out of prison. One night when there was a riot, it was a sit down. And there was 107 guys out in the yard. And, you know, we had a pretty tight crew. Like, there was a bunch of us that we knew each other. Like, this guy I was just talking about a little while ago, like, he was there. And there was a couple other guys that I grew up with on the street and knew from the street. And we were all, like, we had a pretty good, strong crew in Renews. You know, as time progressed, more guys were coming in that I knew. So, you know, you start to create, we'll say, like a safety net, right? So you have a crew. Anyway, we were out in the yard. There was 107 of us because they had implemented, the institution had implemented a bunch of rules. And they came at us all at once and changed a bunch of things in our routines. And the guys were losing their minds, right? They were like, hell no. Like, what are they doing? So anyway, 107 of us went out to the yard. And we were out there all night. We broke through the cinder brick wall, got the canteen, and we broke through the fences and got some firewood. And we were, anyway, I think the reality of me dying in prison or never getting out of prison became very real that night, because they were talking about, like, there were crews of people that were talking about if the institution didn't give us what we wanted, that they were actually going to start killing people. And I think that kind of changed my perspective of how serious. I mean, I'd seen a lot of like assaults and seen some stabbings and, you know, things like that happen. And, but that night was like how quickly things could turn and somebody could lose their life or somebody, you know, or you could be involved with it somehow and ended up being staying there for the rest of your life. Like, it could happen very quickly in there. You know, like I said, the belief systems are different, right? How people look at things are differently. And it's very dangerous, definitely very dangerous. And there's no, like I said, there's nothing in there to support people to change their way of thinking. If you're, I always tell them, if you're doing a, even if you're taking a program in there, you're doing 1 or 2 hours of programming once or, you know, even five times a week. Even if you go 5 days a week to a program, you know, a couple hours. Well, the other 22 hours a day are spent in the University of Bad Habits.
Pete, you've mentioned this University of Bad Habits. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that and where that phrase comes from for you.
So I call it the University of Bad Habits because you're taking, what's the best way to word it? People that are already damaged in our society, right? So, you know, mental health, addictions, people with severe traumas. This is what fills our prisons right across the country. So, you know, when you take all people with all these types of backgrounds and you put them all into one spot, what do you expect them to learn? You know, let's be real. Like, when you, it's very simple, really, when you think about it, right? Like, it's like, oh, well, corrections, everybody thinks. But when you start to really think about, you know, the living situation, so you have people in there that are there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and they're all piled into one area. And programming is very limited. Education is very limited. Supports, mental health supports is very limited. All these tips. I mean, we know what it's like out here, you know, in the community for these types of things. So you can only imagine when you have no access, you know, everything has to be accessed through other people, has to be approved, everything. It's not like, oh, I can call a doctor up today. Oh, I'm feeling suicidal. Let me call the hotline. It doesn't work that way. So if you're trying to teach somebody not to be violent, but yet everything in there is enforced by violence. Right. Segregation is another one. You know, if you're talking about people with mental health issues and, you know, if you segregate them and put them by themselves day after day after day, you know, it's not healthy without any type of intervention. While I was incarcerated, so prior to my incarceration, I didn't believe in hard drugs. I was like dead set against them. I was like, no, I never do cocaine, never do opiates, never do IV drugs, all this kind of stuff. Like I said, prior to my first incarceration, my addiction was alcohol and THC. That was my two big drugs. And what happened was, is that the more time that I did, the more normalized these other substances became. The more normalized how they use these substances became. So if you're surrounded by people that are using these substances, like, you know, people are using, talking about cocaine all the time as if it's nothing, right? It becomes normal. Oh, well, my buddy over here, he's using it. Why not? Right. You know, they're smoking crack or they're smoking meth or they're, you know, using IV. It all becomes normalized because it's being discussed all the time. When the substances get into the prisons, that's how they're being used. you know, I've thought about it so many times over the years about how my substance has progressed, and it had a lot to do with a combination of things, obviously, but normalization was one. Another one was, you know, the trauma that was happening to me, myself. They won't call it trauma, though. They will not call it trauma yet, because they're scared to death. If they say that prisons traumatize people, then they're going to have to pay them. Right? So that will not come out, I don't think, for a long time. But our prison system is definitely traumatizing. Definitely traumatizing.
Pete found it difficult to reintegrate back into normal life after serving time. Getting involved with Seventh Step, a program that seeks to help inmates reintegrate into society, helped Pete find purpose.
For my entire life, until I found Seventh Step, my entire life, I always had to hide in the shadows. Always had to hide my past. Every job that I'd ever gotten, anybody that I ever talked to, because I didn't have anything else, right? My entire life was spent from the time when I was 18 until, you know, 15 years ago, I was in and out of prison, in and out of prison, in and out of prison. So for me to sit down and talk about anything to do with life, I'd be lost. I'm like, you know, I don't even know how to work the television. I don't even know how to work my phone. I don't know how to work a computer. You know, like, so for me to sit down and have a conversation with somebody, a normie, they'll say, I didn't know how to do that. And so even like getting jobs, and even in the life, like some people, like, you know, I went to work in construction. And even in construction, there's a lot of people that use drugs and stuff like that. And, you know, there's a lot of those types. But they still don't know how to deal with a guy that's done multiple federal sentences in a maximum security prison. Like, that is just, whoa, you know, that's a little outside my realm, right? The weekend warrior kind of guy. So for me to sit down and even talk about, oh, yeah, man, I was, you know, I just did, you know, 8-year bid for robbing banks and, you know, who's like, whoa. Nobody's inviting you over to supper, let's put it that way, right? So, you know, it was kind of had that effect which reinforced all the other stuff that was inside of me, all those belief systems about hiding and being in the shadows and not, you know, talking about anything. You know, it always reinforced that stuff. So getting involved with Seven Step has really allowed me to figure out a way to turn my life story into an asset to help others and to come out of the criminal justice system and stay out of this, and give other people those opportunities that I was given. You know, I was talking to a guy on the phone this morning. He was telling me that he had just did up enough in a rig to kill himself. Literally, this morning. Right? He calls me up and he's like, man, he said, I got a gram of coke in this rig. He said, I'm done. Right. And then after talking for 15 minutes, he emptied it, you know, and it's because I was talking in a language that he understood. Right. I tell people all the time that, you know, myself and others in my position in Seven Step are translators, right? Because we're talking different languages. You know, when a person is in prison or coming out of prison, it's a totally different language, you know. They feel slighted. They feel like, you know, that the world has moved on without them. There's so many different things that are happening internally, trying to deal with that belief system that you had to live by to survive, and how that fits in the community and society. You know, when I tell a guy that when I first got out and I went to, when I went to the fridge, I was at my mother's house and I went to the fridge to get something to drink. And I opened up the fridge and I got so overwhelmed by the choices that my anxiety went up. I didn't know what to do. I got all disoriented and I actually closed the fridge and forgot what I was even there for and had to walk away from the fridge without even getting a drink. Guys are like, oh man, yeah, that happened to me the other day. Like, you know, where they go to a mall and somebody, or go to a store and somebody rubs up against them. You know, and they, cool, right? Your first instinct is like, what's your problem? Like, you know, because in jail that don't happen. People don't rub up against you. They don't touch you. Nobody touches you unless there's something, you know, going on, right? And if somebody does touch you by accident, it's corrected immediately. There's none of this, oh, walk by and rub into somebody. And like, so these little types of things. And so when the person is talking to them and saying, yeah, no, man, I get it. Like, you know, this happened to me. I still deal with that stuff. You know, I've been out of prison for 15 years. And if somebody rubs into me, I'm like, whoa, hey, whoa. You know, it's not like a just, whatever. In my mind, I go right back to that moment and you know, those neural pathways, right? Like we're talking about, they flare up, right? It's like, oh, you know. And I think that's why it's so important to have somebody there supporting you through different stages as well.
Through understanding and positive support networks, Seventh Step hopes to make it easier for people dealing with the trauma and impact of incarceration to make a new path. For Pete, helping previously incarcerated individuals helps the community, so the community should be ready to help them.
I get a lot of questions, well, how can I help? How can I help? Like, especially when they come to the groups and some of the stronger or bigger groups, you know, they'll say, well, how, you know, it's kind of overwhelming. How do I get involved? I said, stick around. I said, you're going to hear sooner or later where you're going to have an opportunity to open a door for someone, right? Or you connect somebody, or, you know, those types of things, right? Because it takes a community. You know, it takes a village. We all know the old saying, right? It takes a village. And this is no different.
Thank you so much, Pete, for being here. We really appreciate it. If you're listening and want to get in touch with Pete or learn more about 7th Step, go to 7thstep.ca.